Welcome to the Fairview Lodge in the lovely Story City and to the forum for candidates running for open seats in Iowa Senate Districts 23 and 25. My name is Tasita Barfoot. I'm a member of the League of Women Voters of Ames and Story County. For those of you who do not know, the League of Women Voters is a nonpartisan political organization with the primary mission of encouraging active, informed citizen participation in their government. The candidates joining us today are from Senate District 23, Democrat and incumbent Herman Kurmbach. Eric Cooper, who is a Libertarian, was not able to join us tonight. From Senate District 25, Republican and incumbent Annette Sweeney, also Democrat Tracy Freese. First will be the candidates' opening statements. We'll start with Herman Kurmbach.
Thank you to the League of Women Voters for sponsoring tonight's forum. Full disclosure, I have been a dues-paying member of the League for about 25 years now, following in my mother's footsteps, who was a member back in the 50s and 60s. I represent District 23, which includes Ames, Kelly, and Grant, Milford, and Washington townships. So I'm not in my district right now, but thank you for hosting us, and thank you all for coming out tonight. I have served 16 years in the Iowa Senate. Before then, I served 7 years on the City Council in Ames. I'm an economics professor at Iowa State University. I have a whole variety of different community involvements. I co-chaired the Veterans Memorial Committee that built the Veterans Memorial. Maybe you've driven by it at 5th and Grand in Ames. I also continue to serve on the Ames Patriotic Council. I am the immediate past president. So, in the Senate, I've served on quite a number of committees. Throughout my service there, I have served on the Education Committee. As an educator, I've been a classroom teacher almost all my adult life, including a couple years at high school, at the high school level early on. And let's just say I have infinite admiration for those who can make a career of teaching at that level. I also have served on the Ways and Means Committee. That's the Tax Policy Committee. Somehow they thought an economist might know something about that. Local Government Committee is a committee that I have served on throughout. I've also served at various times on Judiciary, Human Resources, Transportation. I was on the Economic Development Budget Subcommittee for a couple of years, and for the last 14 years served on the Education Appropriations Subcommittee. So I helped make education policy, and I helped try to pay for it. I want to talk about the topic that I think is most important to the future of Iowa and the future of Iowa's kids, and that's education. These days, to get a decent job, to hold a decent job, to make a decent living, to provide for a family, to be an active participant in the community, to be a contributor to that community, you need to have a good education. And we have focused heavily on K-12 in the last 15 years. I served as chair of the Education Committee for 6 of those years and continue as ranking member. We created the 4-year-old voluntary preschool program, and we have about 70% of the kids in Iowa participating in that. 70% is great, but we need to do even better. That investment in early childhood education pays amazing dividends down the line in terms of educational success and in all kinds of other dimensions of personal life. We helped to establish the first statewide curriculum standards in Iowa. We were the last state to do that, but we did finally get it done. And I think that we have helped to raise the sights for our school districts, raise the bar to help them to modernize their programs and so forth. I was chair of the Education Committee in 2013 when we passed the bipartisan education reform bill that created the Teacher Leadership Program, a program that allows teachers to progress in their profession without having to leave the classroom. All right, it's where senior teachers can mentor younger teachers. They can pass along the expertise and the value of their experience. Every school district in Iowa has adopted that program now. At the college level, we need to keep the quality up and the cost down. And I've been very disappointed the last couple of years. We have cut the university budget's $33.6 million. Community colleges have been cut $1.3 million. We're not helping these kids to get the education they need, whether it's a 2-year or 4-year program. They have to be able to afford it. They can't graduate with so much debt that they are now carrying. That's just got to change. We've got to reverse that. That's part of a longer-term trend, you know, adjusted for inflation. The Regents' universities have been cut $200 million over the last 20 years. We are limiting the ability of students to move forward with their education, with their skills, with their income earning power. And that hurts not only them, it hurts the business community in the state. The biggest business problem we have right now is not being able to fill the high-skilled jobs that businesses have open. Our jobs problem is one of filling those jobs and getting the kids, getting the young people the skills they need to do that. Everybody gains from that.
Thank you, Herman. Next, we have Annette Sweeney from District 25.
Good evening, everyone, and thank you so much for taking time out of your evening to come tonight to get to know the candidates, and also for the League of Women Voters that have arranged this and organized it. It does take a lot of time, so thank you so much. I still live in the same house I grew up in. I went to college in Nebraska, taught school in Illinois, and at the time of my dad's death, I moved home and started farming with my mom. I have no brothers, and my sister is continuing her education in Florida at the time. I moved home in the early 80s, so if you ever hear any people that involved in agriculture at that time, I can pretty well keep up with those stories about how bad it was in the 80s. But to make a farm and a place to work and to be able to continue the legacy that my parents started. I then got married to my husband, Dave, who is with us tonight, and he believed in that farm legacy, too. So, we live on the same place that I grew up on to continue that legacy for our two young sons. I guess they're not so young anymore. I guess one's 29, so I better make sure that our sons are there on the farm. Also, Jim is an engineer, graduated from Iowa State. And Joe is starting in aquaculture and also a graduate of Iowa State University. And throughout that time, through the 80s, growing up, my husband and I had cattle, crops, and soybeans, and then my husband had to get an off-farm job because of the economy in the 80s, and I started a publishing business in my home as well as farming. And so with this publishing business, we did it for 10 years, and I employed five other people to help me out with this business, kept them all in their own homes to be able so they could stay home with their children, and then we would work seasonally on cattle catalogs. Yes, there are cattle catalogs. And with that, then, I was asked to see if I would like to run for the House in Iowa, and I was very grateful that I had individuals approach me and ran for office at that time. I was in the Iowa House for 4 years, and I was on the Agriculture Committee, Natural Resource Committee, Education, Agriculture, Appropriations. And then when redistricting happened, it wasn't kind to me, but during that 6 years, I had experiences that I also bring those to the table, too, if I am reelected in November. And bringing, you know, home business, farming, agriculture, and then at the USDA, I learned so much in order for us to try to knit together the rural and urban divide that we have happening here in the state of Iowa and also across the United States. I got to learn about our small communities even more with the USDA. And we have a number of issues that are going on that we need to make sure broadband is one of them. And my son, when he started his first fish business, he couldn't get any internet access at that time. And so we need to, that's one of the things that I would like to work on when we're back down at the State House this year. And so the quick election to be elected here to be the senator in this District 25, I'm very humble and I'm very grateful. And again, thank you so much for being here this evening.
Thank you, Annette. And next we have Tracy Fries, also from District 25.
Hello, everyone. My name is Tracy Fries. I am running in Senate District 25, and I was born and raised in Clinton, Iowa. My mom, Jane, was permanently disabled by multiple sclerosis in 1985. She was 28, and I was 2. I look back, and I'm not sure how I would have handled that same situation. At the same time, my parents had decided to split up, unfortunately, and because my mom couldn't work, let alone barely walk, I was literally raised on Social Security and child support. And I have memories of free and reduced lunches, subsidized driver's ed, and a handicap sticker hanging in on our rearview mirror. I spent weekends with my dad in rural Cedar County, and eventually he went on to marry my stepmom, Mary. And then I was really excited because I was an only child, and so I got two stepbrothers, and that's pretty cool when you're a little kid. And my dad's a proud member of Plumbers and Pipefitters Local 125. I got my work permit at age 15, and I got my first job, Taco Bell, where I was promoted to a manager at 16. I worked through college at Taco Bell, and I remember when I went to start interviewing to get the job after college, people thought it was like an anomaly that I had spent 6 years at one fast food restaurant, but I did. And I received my bachelor's degree in business administration from a private Catholic college called the Franciscan University. I worked hard to graduate in 3 years, and immediately after graduation, I got my first job in finance, and I moved to Cedar Falls in 2005. There, I fell in love with a man from Grundy County. It's always a man. And we got married, and I moved to Dyke in 2008. So Ben and I have three kids, ages 3, 6, and 7. Ben works at the physical plant at UNI and is a proud member of AFSCME. The kids have been enjoying the what I call the three P's of campaign life, which is pancakes, piñatas, and parade candy. I then went on to get my master's degree in organizational communication from UNI while working at the same time as a financial planner and a trust officer. Specifically, I worked on moving family farm assets from one generation to the next through proper estate planning. When I was 30, I decided to chase two dreams, one owning my own company and teaching at the college level. So I became an adjunct instructor at Hawkeye Community College and launched a global business from my kitchen table in Dyke. I want to echo what Annette just said, that I could not have done that without broadband internet, and it is incredibly important. I wanted to leverage technology to reach a wider financial audience across multiple industries, and that was the way I was going to do it. Today, Strong Estate LLC is growing, and it employs 7 people. I don't just talk about progressive politics. I tell you all of this to let you know that my life is grounded in them. I didn't fall through the cracks, and I've been able to give back to my society now as a job creator. It's my firm belief that real change happens from the bottom up, not the top down. So why on earth would I run for office as if I didn't have enough going on? Well, his name was Bill Dix, and last summer, a working mom just like me, Kirsten Anderson, was awarded $1.75 million in a wrongful termination suit against the Iowa Republican Senate. Specifically, Bill Dix fired Kirsten hours after she reported a toxic work environment filled with sexual harassment. After some gory details, the jury sided with Kirsten, and the Iowa taxpayers footed the bill. Dix was my senator, and I realized I had a unique opportunity to stand up for working families and make sure that that debacle was not swept under the rug. Roughly 7 months ago, karma caught up with Bill Dix on a bar stool in Des Moines, and he resigned. The dynamics of my race changed. Today, I fight for public school funding, and I'm proud to have been endorsed by the Iowa State Education Association. I'm also a champion of organized labor and have been endorsed by every major labor union. I'm an unapologetic, progressive candidate, people and planet above profits, justice for all. So I want to end here because this is the League of Women Voters, and it's a topic that the press keeps asking me about. Is there a pink wave? Yes, I think there is. But I want to be very specific that it's not one party or another, it's all parties. And looking around at my immediate area, I see candidates like Amanda Reagan, Shannon Latham, Annette, myself, Brenda Brink, and we're paving the way for a legislative makeover, no pun intended. Over the summer, I walked in a couple parades.
Yeah.
And I couldn't help but see how amazingly well-behaved Democrats and Republicans can be. They came together and enjoyed each other's company while waiting for the tractors and the fire trucks to line up, and I don't mind saying publicly, it was a pleasure. So it's my belief that women candidates can cut through the power trips, come together with patience and compromise, and while there are that there's like many areas of agreement that Republican and Democratic platforms can come together on. We all may value different things up here, but we're still human. And I really believe that women understand that. So thank you.
Thank you, Tracy.
I'm Leroy Kester, Story City resident.
reference the United Nations report of last week. What are we going to do at the State House, and what are you individuals going to do to try to help reduce the impact that all of the citizens of Iowa have on the contribution of carbon dioxide, methane, how it changes our agriculture, weather patterns, our rivers, our flooding. All of that is related to climate change. We have 10 to 12 years. What's the urgency, and how are you going to deal with it for each of the candidates?
Thank you. Herman?
Well, we have a serious problem, and it is indeed a global problem. There are some folks who still want to deny that that's going on, that humans had anything to do with it. But if you talk to any scientist at all who have been involved in that, it's clear we are in a crisis. The ocean temperatures, the violence of storms that are growing, this is something that has to be addressed and has to be addressed soon. You know, the hurricane that came ashore in Florida, Panhandle just a day or so ago, the hurricane in North and South Carolina. I mean, the violence of these storms is growing. And the effects in other areas are quite clear. Sea levels are rising. Some people may want to ignore that, but the U.S. Defense Department isn't. They're worried about their military bases that are located on seacoasts. Insurance companies are starting to worry about, the bond people are warning local governments about, and investors in local bonds, about how secure those bonds are going to be if local governments, if local communities have to deal with flooding and intensive storms. There are a couple of things that we have promoted. We are certainly doing a great job in this state on wind energy, non-polluting wind energy. I've also worked on geothermal with, by the way, a guy who I think, I don't know if he now is, but was the Republican vice chair in Story County. We worked together to promote geothermal energy. Solar energy, we have a solar energy project going in Ames that people are buying into to help create a solar field there. Again, non-polluting renewable energy. But we need to do more at the national level. Withdrawing from the Paris climate change, the climate agreement, set us backwards and set us in isolation from all of the other nations on the globe. We need to resume a leadership position, not a turn tail and retreat position. So I appreciate that. There is a role to be played there with renewable energy like biodiesel and ethanol, and I have supported the modest tax breaks that those get in the marketplace in Iowa, and I would continue to do so.
Thank you, Herman. Annette?
I think we need to start here at home. And it's really exciting that my husband and I have been very involved in South Fork Watershed Alliance. And we have been collectively 15 years. We have over 3 miles of buffer strips along our property and before it goes into a dredge ditch. So we've got those buffer strips there set up to in order to take reduce those nutrients that are going into our water supply. And so we're very involved with that. And you know, if you're talking water quality, I'm your candidate, because with that we have actively involved, put in stream buffers, water buffers, different types of plantings along streams and water. So that really, really helps with our water quality. And then we're talking about renewable future, that what we want to do with our renewables. And I was co-chair of America's Renewable Future with the ethanol and the biodiesel. And I'm very excited about that. The American Lung Association has also endorsed ethanol here for to be able to be used in the United States, and I am so excited that we're going to be able to sell and to be able to use 15% ethanol here in the state of Iowa. And that was with the vapor levels and what happens with that particular blend of ethanol, but now we're going to be able to use it. So I think that is a great step forward.
Yeah, thank you, Annette. Tracy?
So my feelings on that report was that it certainly feels urgent, and I feel semi-helpless. And one of the things that I chuckle about is that my husband still to this day will take the six-pack containers and cut them, right, so that fish don't have their head stuck in them. And that was something I was taught when I was in, like, kindergarten or something to that effect. And so I laugh that he still does that today. And I guess as a role of government and legislature, you know, twofold here, give us some of those easy action steps to take so that we don't feel helpless, so that we can feel like we're really getting involved. I know that there are a lot of excellent you know, environmental conservation efforts that are involving things like, and you can maybe tell me something on this, but like socks and charcoal that will clean water and just things that are very easy and available. And I know that there's a farm on Highway 65 that is developing those kinds of simple technologies like buffer strips that are simply there to, you know, use the environment to help the environment. So that's awesome. But we need to have action steps. So I think that if we're talking about a government, maybe task force of some kind, that could give us those steps, give us what we can do as people. And then also, I know that the funding for energy efficiency was rolled back in the last session. Mm-hmm. And I would say that that is something that should be reversed so that we can focus again on energy efficiency or incentivize wind, solar, et cetera.
I'm Joanna Coiteau. I'm from Ames. I'm really concerned about the First Nations and the pipeline, and I wonder what you think about it, because I'll start crying when I think about the indignity that First Nations have to endure, and I feel that we should leave them alone and should leave their sacred ground alone, and I just wonder what your take on it is. Thank you.
Thank you. Herman?
Well, there was quite a bit of controversy in the last couple of years about the Dakota's Access Pipeline coming through Iowa, coming through Story County. And a lot of people were pretty unhappy that the promoters of that pipeline could use eminent domain to grab the land that they wanted, cutting across people's farms, cutting across roads, cutting across the state. Now, somehow or another, that pipeline was defined as a public utility by the Public Utilities Board, even though it didn't serve a single customer anywhere in Iowa. I thought that was a disgrace. You know, about 10 years ago, 12 years ago, we passed a bill to limit the use of eminent domain. Now, sometimes it's going to happen. You got to build a road, you got to build a road, and you need land to do that, and whoever is farmland or whatever land gets taken needs to get fair compensation. That's under the U.S. Constitution and the Iowa Constitution and Iowa law. But to give that power not to the Department of Transportation, not to a public authority, but to give it to a private for-profit company just rubbed me raw. And the people who went out there, the First Nations people and all the other folks from this nation who went out there to protest that, they were exercising their constitutional rights. And yet, for some reason, the majority party in the legislature this year chose to pass a bill to try to make that illegal. Now, nothing in that bill, no action in that bill that was cited, was legal. Everything mentioned in that bill was already illegal. But what they wanted to do was beat up on people who were involved in that protest and to scare them off from future protests. I thought that was awful. I thought that was absolutely awful. And the First Nation people who fought that, especially up in the Dakotas, good for them. You know, those are their tribal lands. Those are their ancestral lands. That's their separate nation, you know, under the treaties that have so often been violated. You know, they have a separate nation. But they were denied their rights as well.
Thank you, Herman. Annette?
That was very concerning what happened in the Dakotas. And I called a friend of mine that's up there that lives and ranches up in the Dakotas. What was done was despicable when people let out their cattle. They found dead baby calves where the protesters were disfiguring. And so the door swung both ways on that particular issue. To leave our First Nations, we need to respect their time, their area, and the treaties that have happened. And with the pipeline, it was my understanding there had been some tribal meetings with the pipeline, and they needed to continue. And when you were talking about the despicable things that went on up there, and with my friends that are ranchers up there, as well as some of the nations that are up there raising livestock and trying to keep their families going, that was despicable also.
Thank you, Annette. Tracy?
Well, I think that it illustrates quite clearly the situation that profits got in the way of people. And, you know, eminent domain abuses. Eminent domain has its place, I believe that, but it can be abused. And I think that illustrated it very clearly. I am not completely aware of all the specifics that my colleagues are referencing of, you know, most despicable instances. I know that there was just such a reaction, and it tells me that communication had broken down and that communication in general probably should have been utilized more. I don't know if we would consider it diplomacy, but, you know, attempting to compromise to get a solution if the pipeline was meant to be, then I feel like all the parties and the stakeholders should have come together and either compromised and agreed or agreed to disagree and not move forward. So somewhere in there, I suspect money got in the way.
Thank you, Tracy.
Clark Ford from Ames. When I went to college, public education was relatively inexpensive. Now we have students and families who are indebting themselves at an incredible level, and we have seen what seems to me to be pretty steady erosion of state funding over the last several decades. And so I'm wondering what your commitment to public higher education is.
Tracy?
Well, I'm one of those households or people who have crushing school debt, and it stops. I mean, it's what, the equivalent of a really nice car payment every month. And I don't regret that. I mean, it's what I had to do. It's what, I mean, even with help, you know, from Pell Grants and subsidized loans, it's still a large amount of money, and then having 2 degrees on that. So, I mean, it is difficult. It also stops you from being able to maybe buy homes as quickly as you'd want to. And, you know, you're working hard. You got dual income households. I mean, I would have loved to have stayed home with my kids, but I wasn't able to afford that. And school loan and school debt, it all factors into that equation. So millennials, especially, and or 10 years younger than me at this point, it's a hard lift with school debt. So one of the things I had mentioned earlier is that there's some things on the platforms between Democrats and Republicans that align. This is one of them, of funding, you know, job training. And not, you know, not everyone wants or is going to succeed as a four-year public student. And so when we talk about, you know, public education cuts, a place like I work, Hawkeye Community College, it's been cut as well. And so to me, it's figuring out a mix of investment and making sure those investments go toward the right skills training. And, you know, if nothing else, at least cut the interest rates on student loans. We can do that. We don't need to be profiting off of student debt. So when it comes to investments, I mean, I know that the money has to come from somewhere, and I hope that it's funneled into what we agree on, which is like middle skills, you know, plumbers, pipe fitters, dental assistants. We're all going to need to be able to flush our toilets in 10 years, so I think we need to figure that out. But that's just my thought. So hopefully we can look at it from more of a perspective of not necessarily going to college, but also job programs like Herman had discussed earlier. There are a lot of solutions to maybe make it so that it's not always, you know, the degree that you want, but maybe the degree that will get you paid once you graduate. I guess I see those things as all aligning in the overall concept of where to invest for our tax dollars so that, you know, they're being funneled so that children are not even children, adults at that point are being successful. You want success. I mean, that's what we all want.
Thank you, Tracy. Mm-hmm. Herman?
Well, thank you for the question. It really kind of lands in my wheelhouse. I wrote a series of op-eds that appeared in the Ames Tribune last March on public higher education and funding and how much of a burden it was becoming for students and what we were doing with the money instead. Here's the famous graph, and I didn't create this. It's from the Board of Regents. There are two lines, and they cross. Okay? You go back to 1981, state support was up here. Tuition support was down here. You come to today, and those levels have reversed. We are balancing our budget this year on the backs of Regents University students. Ms. Reynolds comes out with a $124 million surplus. Well, she should write a letter of apology to every Iowa State student, every UNI student, every U of I student, and to their parents. Because the cuts to the universities the last 2 years, that's what created much of that so-called surplus. And by the way, she's already spent the surplus already with $104 million increase in payments to these MCOs. I hope we get a little bit more time to talk about the Medicaid mess. There's another graph in here that I did create. It's looking at the number of hours a student would have to work at minimum wage in order to pay for tuition. And you can see how steeply that has gone up over the last couple of decades. It used to be up until the mid-1980s that a student working full-time in the summer and part-time during the school year could earn enough to pay tuition, room, and board at Iowa State without help from parents. These days, that student could work full-time year-round and still not cover the costs. Tuition, room, and board has gone up twice as fast as inflation in the last 50 years. I went back that far to look at it. And what are we doing with the money instead? Well, I'll give you a three-word answer to that. Google, Apple, and Microsoft. What do those three companies have in common? Two things. They are the three richest companies in the U.S. economy by market capitalization. And the other thing they have in common is that your tax dollars, Iowa tax dollars, are subsidizing all three of them. What a crazy situation that is. For each $1 million that we give to Google for one job, we could have funded 121 full tuition scholarships at Iowa State a year ago. Or if you don't think kids should get a free ride, and by the way, I don't. I think they should have some sweat equity in there. We could have given 242 half-tuition scholarships for each one job created at Google. And God bless the guy or the gal who got that job at Google. But if you think they got the $1 million, you got another thing coming.
Thank you, Herman. Annette?
Higher education funding, we talked about the interest rates. They are really high. Our oldest son right now is paying close to 7% on his student loan. That needs to be reduced. We agree on that. And so we're talking about higher education funding. Well, the Regents were cut in 09 and 10 by a across-the-board cut with administration in which Senator Kornbach was involved with, that they 10% cut out the door.
Because of the Bush recession, yes.
You still cut 10% across the board. And then what happened was that it fell upon the Regents that they got basically a 20% cut because we had to pull money out of the Regents into our higher education. So right now we're still trying to rebuild, but education has not been cut since that time. And so we talked about, you know, in 81, you know, how much we paid for tuition. And so it's a lot different now. And to make things be able to, for students to be able to afford that, I agree that we need to make sure that our Regents are fully funded. And our community colleges, they're doing a great job. And there are a lot of students in our area that are going to a community college first 2 years and then going on to the rest of the four-year college, which is really making that really affordable for a lot of young individuals. And also people my age are now starting going back to college.
Absolutely.
And that's a lot of fun when people want to further themselves. And so, you know, the student debt, and we are also, there's a successful program, I was looking this up, at University of Northern Iowa to address the growing student debt problem. And they've got Live Like a Student, and it's a counseling and financial literacy program for students. How awesome is that? To be able to understand how much it's going to cost, what their financial obligations are going to be, and then to help them make that work. So I think there's a lot of things that we can do together to be able to afford the higher education.
Hello, my name is Renee Klaus. I'm from Ames, Iowa. I've gone from a for-profit business to a nonprofit business in healthcare. And with the addition of Medicaid being not MCOs, it breaks my heart what this state has done to our impoverished folk in this state. And to see that you add a third layer of payer is what is the downfall of this system. Mm-hmm. I don't know one baker in the state of Iowa that would add a third layer to a cake and charge you less. And that's what we have done to the state of Iowa by adding an entire new payer system with these insurance companies. And I want to know which one of you, maybe a better way to say that is, do you support getting rid of the MCOs or do you not? It's a yes and no question.
Annette, it's your turn.
No.
Tracy?
Yes.
Herman?
Absolutely. It's been a disaster.
Yes.
And I hope we could talk a little bit more than just yes or no. The details are pretty shocking.
All right. Tracy?
Sure. So obviously I have, as I shared at the beginning, a very intimate understanding of Medicaid because my mother is on Title 19 and I'm her only child and she's unmarried. So I help her out with everything, but not everyone has a Tracy to help them. And I listen to not just what my mother has dealt with because it's anecdotal, right? That's just my experience with it. And it hasn't been overly negative, but she also is not at a point where she needs a large amount of care either. But she will get there at some point. Her disease will progress to that point. And so I need to keep in mind and be aware of that as we move forward because no one is getting any younger. So I am more concerned about what I hear from constituents. First and foremost, we are facing a nursing shortage or a nursing crisis coming at us because of what I'm told Medicaid reimbursements are not high enough, and so nurses will go to a different state because they can get paid more. And so that was an interesting thing that someone had told me, one of my voters in the field. And another thing is I heard two pharmacy, one owned a pharmacy and one was a pharmacist in rural Iowa, and they had both said in separate cities that because of reimbursement not being high enough, they aren't going to be able to go out to homebound patients anymore. So I thought, well, that's, something we shouldn't move forward, and see that happen. Then the last thing that I have is that the Story County Hospital or clinic in Nevada has stated or tells me that if reimbursements don't get up higher for them, then it's going to mean that they're going to stop rural ambulance service to Colo, Collins, Zeering, Maxwell. Wow. And I'm hearing these real world things. And so I guess that would more than likely state that reimbursements should be higher, because I did ask the one pharmacist, I said, well, tell me how it was when Iowa ran it. And he said, fair. That's all I know. So there again, it goes back to my feelings that shareholders' profits should not drive care. It's not a good mix. I mean, they're going to be putting business goals above patients, and I think that that's what you're seeing, is that it's really been a bad situation for patients and providers.
Herman?
Yeah, the Medicaid privatization has been a complete disaster. I can't count the number of phone calls that I have gotten at home from people in my district and some people not in my district who have been relying on Medicaid and medical services through that program for decades. A number of these people are people who have long-term disabilities. They have been cut off from access to the care providers that they have depended on for their independence for decades. They can't get at them anymore. Now, I have serviced a lot of constituent complaints, and we've got some number of them reversed. But the system is broken. All right, the system is broken. And it's broken on the other side as well. I have heard from a lot of providers, individual practices, where the provider, the doctor or dentist, whatever, has had to take out personal loans to make payroll. All right, they've had to put their personal assets on the line to keep their practice in business. And I'm sure that that's going to be rougher even in the smaller towns than in Ames. What I've also heard, and there's data to support this, from the providers, the ones who are still operating, the staffing costs have gone up. Because all of the claims that get denied or delayed or not paid or they have to file 3 or 4 appeals to get them paid, the providers have had to take on additional staff, all right, just to handle the paperwork. How is that improving efficiency? How is that improving efficiency? Here's another one that really galls me. Long-term care ombudsman. You know what that is? That's a state office that is supposed to be the advocates for people in nursing homes, people who feel that they're not being treated well, there's something going on that needs to be looked at by by somebody outside at that nursing home. The Long-Term Care Ombudsman's Office, the budget cuts this last year, the Long-Term Care Ombudsman's Office canceled their travel budget. They don't go out to visit nursing homes anymore. How else are they supposed to do their job in representing and advocating for those patients if they can't even go out and see what's going on? And here's the really painful irony. It was in the news just in the last couple of days. You know, that's part of the Medicaid program. So the federal government would pick up part of the costs if Iowa would ever bill them. We haven't billed them this calendar year. We would be owed over $200,000. If we would simply send an invoice to the federal government. But MCO is there improving efficiency, they're cutting costs. That's why under the agreement signed recently by Ms. Reynolds, that we're going to be paying them $333 million more next year. And about $100-something million is coming out of your pockets as state taxpayers, your pockets and mine. I resent the heck out of that. It is a less efficient system that costs more and treats patients worse. Other than that, it's a great idea.
Thank you, Herman. Annette?
We all here, I think, agree on the privatization should have been slower instead of all at once. And our state needs to make sure that our monies are being spent where they're supposed to be spent. And so the governor has a new director, and also Mike Randall's with the Iowa Medicaid, and he is traveling the state talking to providers and talking to the hospitals, doctors, etc., and trying to peel back the skin of the onion to find out how come it wasn't working as well as it should, even when the state was just getting just doling out the money without double checking. That was the concern of our legislature. And so the managed care, when a problem was discussed, a lot of times in the system, it would be like a $2,400 and they just pass it off and they wouldn't reimburse the people. I mean, to me, $2,500 is serious cash. So they need to be reimbursed with that. And so I am hoping, and with the governor's renewed support for being able to budget money for the MCOs, I'm looking for improvement, but it's going to be a little rocky.
Thank you, Annette.
This is Leroy Kester, Story City. I was a teacher in 1970 when the negotiation bills was proposed and passed. I believe it was signed by Governor Bob Ray. I was on the negotiations team as a teacher. 3 years later, I was negotiating for the school board at another school. So I sat on both sides of that table. It's a very effective communication and sharing of understanding between the teachers, the employees, and the management of a school district or any public entity. So what are each of you going to do to put that back to give public employees their proper voice?
Oh, you're talking about the renegotiation with Chapter 20? With that, I wasn't down there when that happened. And by what I am hearing from the individuals that are on school boards, that are running our community colleges, and also a lot of our principals, they were happy in order to be able to, for them to be able to come to the table and be able to try to negotiate, because before they felt they were really boxed in. So that's my only comment I have on that.
Herman?
At the start of the legislative session in 2017, there were some folks who told teachers that they were only going to make a few tweaks in collective bargaining, a few small changes around the edges of Chapter 20. So if you're hearing those same folks telling you they're not going to change IPERS, I'd watch your bank account. Collective bargaining was a bipartisan creation in this state. The late treasured Governor Bob Ray signed that bill, and for 40 years we had labor peace in this state. No teacher strikes like we've seen in half a dozen other states this year. No blue flu, no firefighter slowdowns, no public employee disruptions, period. Workers had a seat at the bargaining table. They had respect from their employers. They had a voice in the process. Now, are unions perfect institutions? Oh, no, of course not. But neither are school boards and neither is management. You know, you think about it, our whole system of government is a system of checks and balances, of divided power. Right, federal, state, local, three branches of government at each layer, two different houses of Congress. We have chopped up power into lots of little pieces. And the genius of that system is that in order to get anything done, you have to cooperate, you have to negotiate, you have to split the difference with other folks. And collective bargaining is the same sort of philosophy. It's the same philosophy on which our whole government is based. You have unions, and you have management, and you have labor. And if they can work together and take the available resources and divide it up fairly and reasonably according to what can be afforded and what you need to pay teachers and public workers in order to attract and retain quality people, you know, that's a system that worked really well for us for 40 years. Teacher pay, by the way, was not exorbitant in this state. In fact, until the legislature came in about 10, 12 years ago and established a separate little fund to help support teacher salary, the teachers' union was so powerful they negotiated themselves all the way up to 42nd in the country in teacher pay. Okay? Our teachers' union, our other public, AFSCME, our other public sector workers, our police and our fire, they're just asking for respect. They're asking for a decent living. They're asking for the right to bargain for a fair compensation for their labor, and we need to restore that.
Thank you, Herman. Tracy?
I experienced the reality of bargaining cuts myself. My husband is a union employee with AFSCME, and that straight up hit our bottom line by several thousand dollars every year. I mean, the fact that he cannot negotiate, or the union cannot negotiate for his pay increases, his steps were removed from his salary. These things have real-world consequences for families, and so I would work really hard to make it easier to join a union, not harder.
Thank you, Tracy.
I'm a 17-year-old named Olivia Chase from Ames, Iowa. Will you be open-minded to ideas from new generation, my generation, votes from the high school seniors, my grade?
Annette, I believe it's your turn.
My dear, I think that is exciting, and I hope I see you down at the legislature. And in fact, I even helped a group of students, you know, form a bill, and also to show them how they could lobby, you know, and do that. And in fact, I just talked to a group of school children, and we went through a whole dramatization of how a bill becomes a law. It was just so much fun. And to get individuals into the process, I love that. And so I welcome that idea, because that's where the best ideas start. And thank you very much for your willingness to be able to visit with us about those particular ideas.
Thank you, Annette. Tracy?
Wonderful. And you are brave to get up in a microphone surrounded by all these adults who are super active, and that's wonderful. Welcome. Keep going.
Herman?
Am I open to ideas from young people? Well, I certainly better be, because more than half of my constituents are ISU students.
Yeah.
And I have taught introductory economics almost every one of the 28 years that I've been at Iowa State. I have something on the order of 7,000 or 8,000 former students floating around someplace, including one who will remain nameless, who is a colleague of mine in the Senate, a former student of mine. So, yeah, I think young people are great. They have fresh ideas and fresh energy. They need a little schooling in history, but then everybody does. Everybody needs to learn about the background of issues. But please keep coming with your energy. You're our future, and people like you, in your hands, our future will be just fine. Let me suggest one thing to you. What year in school are you?
Senior.
You're a senior. Any interest in being a page in the legislature? Now would be no, seriously.
I always wanted to be.
I actually made this.
She's a complete artist.
Oh. Well, that's fine. I've been a big advocate for arts education. I could use some support down there.
Herman,
seriously, this would be the right time for anybody who knows a high school senior. This is the time of the year when you apply to be a page. Basically, you spend most of the spring semester down there working with the legislators, seeing what's going on, learning a lot about that. And I have a senator who is a former page, and there are others who have been pages who've been involved with the legislature as well. It's a great experience. I'm sorry, I'm done.
Tracy, did you have one more thing to add?
Don't forget to register to vote.
Before we conclude, I want to remind folks to vote on Tuesday, November 6th. Polls are open from 7 a.m. to 9 p.m. Check the Story County Auditor's website for all the election information, polling places, sample ballots, absentee balloting, jurisdictional maps, and more. Check out www.vote411.org for candidates' responses to a series of questions. Thank you to the candidates for taking the time to share your views and for your commitment to serve the people of Story County. And this concludes our candidate forum. Good night.
You have been listening to a forum for candidates running for open seats in the Iowa Senate Districts 23 and 25. District 25 includes Butler, Grundy, and Hardin counties, and all of Story County except for the area covered by District 23, which includes Ames, Kelly, and Grant, Milford, and Washington townships. Candidates for District 23 are the incumbent Democrat Senator Herman Kurmbach. Libertarian Eric Cooper was not able to be present at the forum. Candidates present for District 25 are Republican incumbent Annette Sweeney and Democrat candidate Tracy Freese. The forum was sponsored by the League of Women Voters and held at Fairview Lodge on October 11th in Story City. Thank you for listening, and remember to vote.